Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Everybody get ready for this. There's a lot of sex talk.
Oh, yeah, disclaimer.
Yeah, there's like a, you know.
It's we're going to be talking about sex. You know what, listener? It's a thing. People do it.
Yeah. Let's just give like a quick birds and the bees right off the top. You know,
are we explaining what sex is? Is that what's happening?
When two people love each other.
It doesn't matter what gender they are. When two people love each other very much for a lifetime or an afternoon.
When your chemistry reaches a point where you can no longer ignore your hormones.
When the summer night smiles at you unexpectedly.
When the moon looks a certain way.
When the moon is in the seventh house. Anyway, when two people look at each other across the way and they're both bored and have already eaten lunch.
And the stares, you know, last longer than 3 seconds.
Yes. But not like me and Jeffrey are doing now.
No, this is sustained eye contact with actual conversation.
Actual conversation. Yeah. This is a fake conversation. When two people love each other very much, sometimes their bodies mash together, the two skeletons mash together.
Yes.
And physically something weird happens and then they both shower and go home.
And then feel bad about themselves.
Yes,
and
shame.
And that's the birds and the bees.
And to be honest with you, joking aside, a lot of what Little Night Music is about is some of the complications and baggage that comes with sex.
Agreed.
So learn from it, children.
Teach the children.
Teach the children.
Welcome, everybody, to a musical theater podcast where we discuss the emotional and cultural impact of some of our favorite shows in musical history. My name is Jeffrey Scott Parsons. You can call me Jeff. And today we are talking A Little Night Music. It's our first Sondheim show. Can you believe it?
That's crazy.
It's our first Sondheim show that we're covering. I'm excited that it's A Little Night Music, and I'm really excited that my guest is Tom Zohar.
Hi.
Hello. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
I'm practicing my NPR voice.
This is your podcast voice.
Yes. I can't quite get low enough. Isn't it sad? Like, my voice will not go into my chest in any significant way. My voice naturally just goes up into my cheekbones, and I can't, I don't know.
It's that bone structure.
I definitely, well, thank you. I tried.
Okay. I remember when I first reached out to you about what show we wanted to cover.
Yeah.
And you mentioned A Little Night Music.
Yeah.
And I immediately referenced the first time that I came to know of the show, which was I was in junior high and I was in a car with my friend. Shout out to Katie Pace from Willard, Utah. And we're in the car and I think You Must Meet My Wife came on one of her mixes that she had in playing in her cassette tape player.
Really dating yourself here. Right?
and I was like, oh, what's this show from? And she says, A Little Night Music. And I said, what's that about? And she thought for a beat and then said, sex.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So then we're listening to the song. And then the next song was a track from Candide. And once again, I said, oh, what's this from? And she said, Candide. And I said, what's that about? She goes, actually, this one's about sex, too.
Sex and jewelry. Which I guess they both are, kind of.
So then I tell you that story. Yeah. And you, do you remember what you said to me after that?
Please remind me.
It was my favorite. And you immediately replied with, all entertainment that we think of as elegant and refined is actually about rich people trying to boink.
Abso-friggin-lutely, yes. Yeah, it pretty much anything.
I don't know. There's something about rich people and their privilege that allows them to worry about who they're sleeping with that feels detached from reality.
It's privilege.
As I know it. Yeah. Like, privilege can be defined by how much you think about who you're going to sleep with.
I mean, in some ways, we still have that going on. Some of it has to do with class system. Some of it has to do with looks. I don't know. I feel at least in our community, there's a lot of that going on. You know what I mean?
Where it's like, I want to be with someone, but like, you're going to need to send me a nudie first.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. And if they did Little Night Music nowadays, it would all be taking place on Tinder and Grindr. And, you know,
just be text messages, a series of texts.
For a long time, I thought it would be really funny to do a Little Night Rock Music do it. It's a horrible idea, but that's why it makes me laugh. And just like modernize it and set the same score to like rock music.
Oh.
And I thought it would be so stupid, but what if it's so stupid that it would work? So if anyone anyone's listening to this and want to try it out, just and maybe reach out to Mr. Sondheim and see if he's so desperate at this point that he'll want to try it. I just think it would be a terrible idea, but it might be a terrible idea that could work because it's so bad.
Do you remember? Look, we're already in the theme of the show with all this. Remember? Do you remember back in the day, Columbia House or BMG? With the catalogs of CDs. Do you remember this?
I think so, yes.
You would join the club.
And they send you CDs, right?
They would send you this, like, packet of all of the albums or CDs that the recording company owned. Mm-hmm. And then you had to choose 8 CDs that you could get for the price of one.
Mm-hmm.
So by joining the club, you paid for 1 CD, you'd get 8 for free, and then you had to agree to buy 2 at a discounted price later on.
Oh, that's clever.
I did it twice.
Okay.
I feel like I did it once with each of the companies that were doing that so that I could get as many cast albums as I could.
Uh-huh.
And A Little Night Music was one of them.
Oh.
Along with, like, Vanessa Williams' Kiss of the Spider Woman, a cast album. Just, like, the strangest things. But...
And that's the day you said, I'm gay. This is it.
Nope.
That's no, it was, no.
It was another good 15 years before that one came.
But it helped solidify it. Come on. Vanessa Williams just helped solidify it.
Vanessa Williams was, like, she was Colors of the Wind at that point.
Absolutely.
So it was, like, a step closer to Disney. The more Vanessa Williams that I had in my life.
And anything
the closer
related
to, I was Disney
to Disney, also. Yes. Anyway, we're deviating.
Oh no! So, oh, yeah, right.
Would
so
I
that
watch
was my
Vanessa
favorite.
Williams play Desiree Almfeld? Yes. Did I just come up with that amazing casting idea? Maybe.
I think you just maybe changed the face of musical theater.
I want to see that production now, Vanessa. If you're listening,
Brian Stokes Mitchell as Frederick.
Oh my God. And I'm sure he's played it before, right?
I would hope so.
I don't know. I think I would know if Vanessa Williams had played Desiree before.
And then, like, Felicia Rashad as Madame Arfelt.
Oh, my
Arfelt.
God.
Why aren't we doing
shut
this
Shut the podcast
already?
Down. We are flying to New York. I don't know where the people... Just if the people who manage the people we were talking about are listening...
Make this happen.
And credit us and give us money.
Holy Thank crap.
You. I'm shaking. Yeah. This is so good.
Quivering in perpetual
anyway,
anticipation.
Anyway, that's Vanessa Patel. Okay. Good job.
Okay. We can't. We got to get away
we
from
We got to get away from
person.
Vanessa Williams right now. This is what she does.
She does, too.
She grabs onto you and you don't let go. Okay.
Those blue eyes. I want to begin by talking about how the show came about.
Yeah.
I always talk about She Loves Me, and I promise I don't try to, but it comes up yet again. She Loves Me, 1964.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first show that Harold Prince, Hal Prince, directs. Mm-hmm. Like, he steps outside of his producer plate and directs that show to much critical success. And he and Stephen Sondheim were obviously collaborators, having worked on West Side Story together. So now he's looking for other properties to direct. And one of the ideas that he has is to do a musical version of what
Ring
is
Around the Moon.
Exactly.
Yep.
Now,
don't ask me what the playwright's name is. It's very French and weird.
It is.
Yeah,
it's
Ring
a very
moon.
French name, and I'm not no good at French.
Yeah.
But this was a kind of a well-known play. It's still produced. It was produced down in San Diego.
They just did it in San Diego very recently, yeah.
And they did a Broadway revival of it with Marion Seldes. And it's just, it's kind of along the same lines, right? Rich people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a love farce about rich people and poor people kind of mingling together and the poor people coming in with a plan to try to take over the house in some ways. This is all in very general terms.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have similar themes of like the people who should be together are not together, ended up together. And it does have kind of the magical matriarch who is kind of sassy in a wheelchair, giving, like, the great one-liner and then being wheeled off. It's a fun little lark.
So they reach out to the writer,
yeah,
or at least the lawyer who is overseeing the property, and they refuse to let them have it,
mm-hmm,
to musicalize. So they're like,
stupid.
Oh, you're like, seriously? Do you know who we are? So then they move on.
Uh-huh.
And long story short, too late, what they land on is Ingmar Bergman's film Smiles of a Summer Night.
Yeah.
Ingmar Bergman, of course, a legendary filmmaker that I'd say most people in America don't know, but are probably
the name
influenced by.
Right. Yeah. I mean, when you hear a Bergman film, you have a very specific idea of what that would be. So
he's the type of filmmaker who really changed how films look in terms of cinematography, close-ups, the way that he films close-up. They always talk about a Bergman close-up.
And Smiles of a Summer Night is beautifully shot.
Really?
Beautifully shot. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Legitimately, there are some lines in the movie that are not even in the musical that are very, very funny, but it's shot beautifully.
That's great.
I don't know that I've ever watched a movie fully in Swedish. But literally, after a while, all you hear is brunda, brunda, brunda. Like, it's literally how it sounds. The Swedish Chef from
the Muppets.
It's surprisingly accurate. And I sound like a rube right now. I don't have a lot of Swedish people in my life, so. But it is kind of funny, like.
Well, you were born in Israel, so I think you're given a pass on that
one. A little farther away from Sweden than I'd like to be, but yeah, it's a lot of that. And then every once in a while, you'd hear Desiree says, like, she says a whole sentence, and it ends with "Brunda, brunda, brunda, Fredrik Egerman," and it's just so delicious the way that you. It really is, though, the way they use the language and the names are just Fredrik Egerman. So now I kind of want to see a production of Little Night Music in Swedish.
Oh. Oh, wow.
I'm wondering if it's, I don't know. I'm sure it's been done, but I haven't found anything.
I know that when they did the German production of A Little Night Music,
uh-huh.
It's the only time that they actually used the title of the Bergman film.
Because
it would have been Eine kleine Nachtmusik,
which is
Mozart. So can you imagine people buying tickets to Mozart and then they show up and,
yeah.
And Petra's humping...
They'd probably be okay with it. They'd probably be like, well, this kind of fits. Why do you think he didn't call it Smiles of a Summer Night?
It was Bergman asked.
Really? Because he didn't want it to be too much like the
request is that when they did the musical version that they changed the title, which was fine because Sondheim already knew that he wanted to call it A Little Night Music.
Oh.
That was what he was going to call Evening Primrose. Which was this, like, TV musical that he wrote for Anthony Perkins, right?
I'll take your word for it.
It takes place in this department store, and then he finds out that kind of like Jordan Peele's Us, there's this whole civilization of people living at the department store behind the walls, and, like, they come out at night. Anyway, and they've never been outside. The guy falls in love with the girl, and I remember Sky, like that famous song is from that.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that was supposed to be called A Little Night Music, and then they decided to name it after the short story on which it was based, which is Evening Primrose. So he already had this title that he loved, and it fit perfectly for the show.
No, it's great. And I don't know that I ever completely, until now, understood where that title came from, but it does work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's perpetual night, sort of. I mean,
yeah.
It's funny because the Bergman movie has nothing to do with that. That was one of the few things they put into the musical that did not come from the movie.
Mm.
The movie takes place over several days. It doesn't have anything to do with the sun not setting. Mm-hmm. I love that they inserted the whole idea of the sun not setting in
Me
it.
Me too.
Some of the best lyrics in the whole musical come from that whole concept, but...
Amen.
Yeah.
Okay. Bergman, much to his credit, agrees for his property to be musicalized.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, however, Sondheim and Hellprinz work on several other shows, all of which are, you know, legendary. Mm-hmm. Company, Follies. Neither of which, however, were huge financial successes. Company and Follies both didn't make a lot of money. So then... at least according to Hellprinz, his next goal was to have a financial success.
Always a good goal to have.
Right?
Sure.
So especially since Follies was so magnificent and lost so much money. I'm sure I'll do a Follies episode, but it was at the same time as Two Gentlemen of Verona, which was like a rock version of Shakespeare.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, there's obviously this counterculture type thing that is a little difficult to figure out.
Musical theater in the 70s was a little strange,
yeah.
A little rough. I mean, in all honesty, and we just talked about with a friend of ours this week about how without Sondheim, the 70s would have been a lot of forgotten rock musicals,
mm-hmm.
mostly. Truly, I mean, Sondheim, if you think about the 70s musical theater, you usually think about Sondheim.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The year that A Little Night Music came out, the other big show was Pippin.
Mm-hmm.
So you had all of the, and I mean, it is probably Hellprinz's fault, but you had these shows that had a real artistic point of view based on the director, choreographer,
yeah.
You know, kind of from a conceptual place.
Yeah.
Pippin is not a really well-constructed musical.
No. But, no, I agree.
You know, it's a fine show, but it also requires this really deft hand at how you're going to be doing the storytelling.
Because the concept is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very out there.
So you have projects like that all throughout the 70s, mm-hmm. Pippin being a successful one.
Mm-hmm.
And then up next to it is A Little Night Music, which is beautifully crafted.
Yes. And yeah, exactly, with a really accessible storyline, delicately told, and funny if you do it right.
There's an ease to it. There's an ease to the intellect.
Yes. 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 Exactly. Which fits with the show. Because like I always say that, to me, Little Night Music is like a really greasy, yummy cheeseburger wrapped up in Swarovski crystals. It's like the center of it is very like love and sex and rolling around in the hay and all these things are happening that essentially kind of like fit inside of a sex farce, but it's presented in this sumptuous kind of beautiful, classy veneer that actually really fits it. And that's what makes the show special, I think, that it's both.
So maybe this is kind of a return to a more traditional structure for both of them, but also for the 70s.
Yes.
Where then they're like, all right, well, let's take a step, I don't want to say backward, but a step toward the more traditional and see what we can bring to it. And I think that the show still feels very fresh and pushing boundaries in some ways.
Well, it's a score. I mean, honestly, I would give most of the credit to the score. The fact that the whole thing is in some shape or form in three-quarter time, I don't know that that's been done before.
No.
So, again, honestly, in an alternate universe where someone else scored whatever Smiles of the Summer Night ended up being as a musical, I don't think would have been a successful musical because it wouldn't be as special.
Agreed. So the book writer for A Little Night Music, his name's Hugh Wheeler, and he later wrote the script for Sweeney Todd as well. I think this was their first collaboration together, though. And he wrote his version of the book, and Sondheim said that when he read it, he felt like it was too straightforward, you know, especially coming out of Company and Follies, which were more conceptual. He felt like it was kind of boring and didn't like it. And he said that his mentor, there's this woman that he always goes to, kind of like a Madame Armfelt, who always gives him great advice. And what she said was, yes, this is straightforward and maybe a little outside of your preference, but it will give you an opportunity to really step up your pussy. It will give you an opportunity.
A Little Night Music, step your pussy up, a musical. Yes.
But to really show people what you're made of.
It's more of a challenge.
Yeah, more of a challenge.
Which, again, I think is why the score, to me, sounds very... It's a different Sondheim score. And Sondheim also has a lot of little melodic things he does that he loves to do in almost every show that he does. And they don't really exist in Little Night Music.
I remember when Into the Woods came out, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler hosted the Golden Globes that year. Do you remember this?
I think so.
And they had this great Sondheim joke where Tina Fey turned to Amy Poehler and said, hey, Amy, have you ever performed Sondheim? And she goes, no, I haven't, but I could. Anyone can.
Yes, exactly that. Yes.
And that
so Amy Poehler said it better than me. Yes, absolutely.
No, but you're right. That is missing from the score.
Yeah, because... there's something more legato. It's such a... I sound so smart right now. It's just a little more melodic, like I said. It just feels more... I don't know. It's like a warm kind of like melodic feel to it, where a lot of Sondheim, even the best Sondheim, feels a little colder. So...
Okay, I'm dying to talk about the story, so let's just jump in, yeah?
Okay, stop yelling.
I'm so excited.
Okay, let's do it. Picture this. A bare stage. A piano. A person, usually dressed really well, comes in, plunks down on the piano, goes la 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 la, and an overture starts with a quintet. It's a quintet, right?
Yes. And they all have names, too, which is impressive.
It's all Borgen, Jorgen, and Monken, Flingen, and...
Mrs. something, Mr...
Erlandson.
We got Mr. Lindquist.
Yes.
Mrs. Anderson, Mrs. Segstrom, Mrs. Nordstrom... Not to be confused with the department
store. She's the one who created the department store. That's the
Evening
sequel.
Primrose was based on.
Yes.
And Mr. Erlandson.
And I think this could be so wrong. I think they're named after some of the people who were involved with Smiles of a Summer Night.
Oh, that's nice.
Don't email me or at me if I'm wrong. It doesn't matter. Just enjoy this tidbit, whether it's right or wrong.
Well, it should be right if it isn't.
Thanks.
So they're vocalizing, mm-hmm. and their vocalizing becomes
the overture
of the whole show, mm-hmm. which is really, really fun and introduces the audience to the style of the show,
yes.
which feels like a Little Night Music.
That should be the title of the show.
That's brilliant. Which feels like a kind of an operetta
yeah.
or a song cycle concert.
Like Which that, is why so many opera companies do it. Because
They should.
As they absolutely should. But what's interesting about that is that it's not, I mean, the show is not really an opera if you follow the rules of what an opera is.
Absolutely.
Right?
And I would even venture to say that one of the reasons I love this show so much is that the score and the script complement each other so well.
Yes.
I love listening to the music, but I'm not as satisfied with the music without those delicious book scenes.
I agree.
And if I were to sit down and read the script, I would be wanting the waltzes.
To not have, yeah.
They really do complement each other so well.
Which is interesting because if you look at the 2009 recording of the revival that Catherine Zeta-Jones did, mm-hmm. they put a lot of book scenes in that recording. And when I listened to it, at first I was like, why did they do that? And I thought about it and was like, oh, because it all fits together really well.
Yeah. Great. So the overture happens. Mm-hmm. Then my old lady with the wheelchair
comes in.
Yes. And she is with her granddaughter.
Yes.
And she is, her name is Madame Armfelt.
Yes.
She used to be a courtesan. Like, she got her fortune because she played her cards really well. And actually,
she's playing
cards constantly. One of the big themes in the whole musical is set right here in this first scene between the old and the young.
Mm-hmm.
The theme of cycles, of time.
Yeah, time.
Of, these kind of phases in our lives where you have, she tells the young girl, the summer night sky smiles three times. Once on the young, once on the fools, once on the old.
The old. And Halperin said that the musical is about time. He said it's about wasting time.
Which, once again, is such a perfect match for the score, which mm-hmm. is all based in waltzes, 3/4 mm-hmm. meter in time. You got time there. You've got the idea of night. Mm-hmm. And then all of these characters that represent phases of life.
Mm-hmm.
She is a source of wisdom.
Yes.
She's not necessarily a source of warmth.
At the beginning. Sure. I wish she was my grandmother. I wish.
But I think sometimes, we love that about old people.
Yeah. They just say what they want to say.
Like, I've lived everything, so I don't need to worry about your feelings.
Yeah.
And listen to what I'm saying, not to how you're feeling.
There's this great line that Madame Armfelt has in the movie in Smiles of the Summer Night where she says, I'm so bored of people. I wish I didn't love them so much.
Oh, that's
and I'm like,
aw,
me. Aw, same.
I love people, but sometimes I just want to be around my dog.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Also, there's something very drag about Madame Armfelt. She's like high drag.
Oh, yeah.
Just the tea is being spilt and the shade is being thrown. And
oh, my gosh. I can't wait for somebody to do Madame Armfelt in Snatch Game.
Some nerd out there in a small town does Madame Armfelt to an audience of two.
And just lip syncs to Liaison.
Honestly, I want you to do it, Jeffrey.
No, absolutely not. I can't pull off the wig at my skin tone.
Okay, fine.
The next thing we go to is the house of Frederick Egerman.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And
Frederick
is a middle-aged lawyer who has lost his first wife and has remarried a young, young woman.
Yes.
They've been married for 11 months. She's still a virgin.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't consummated that relationship yet.
No.
To complicate matters even more, he has a son who's only a year older than the bride herself.
Mm-hmm.
So now she's like his new mommy, and that's
very weird.
And he's like a whole ball of existential crisis himself.
He's very angsty, and he has decided to deal with his feelings of angst and confusion by essentially going to priest school.
Yeah, he's in the seminary.
That's what it is. Thank you. I'm a Jew. I don't know how it all works. Yes.
Yeah, he's studying in the seminary, but at the same time is also, like everyone else in the show, horny and no idea what to do with it.
Well, he's also deeply attracted to, who is now his mother, essentially.
Exactly.
And he ends up sort of letting a lot of them out, or trying a lot of things out with Petra, who is willing and totally consenting to all of this.
Petra is the maid.
The maid.
And she's a pretty horny gal herself.
She is self-assured and sex-positive, is what we'll say, because it's true.
Oh, that's good.
She is, thank you. She is just a few years older than Anne, so they have kind of an interesting connection there. But they could not be more different in terms of their views on sexuality, because Anne is very nervous about it. And some of it, I'm sure, has to do with repressingly not realizing that she's with the wrong person.
It's also 1900 Sweden.
Yes. So it's, you know, I guess it maybe wasn't that weird at the time. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, they have a whole conversation about that. So they end up married, I think, almost just because they both felt like it was a necessity. I don't know.
Like, he was supposed to be remarried.
Yeah, and she was
Might as well be someone who's beautiful and young.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a relatable story, I think, to a lot of people.
Sure.
And then she no doubt has what else is she supposed to do?
Well, it's kind of also like, I'm sure it's kind of a father figure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly why, implicitly, she has not had sex with him. And she keeps saying later, later, later. She has a song about it. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert. And he's actually, in his defense, being very patient and not being creepy about it, which I'll give him credit for.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, everyone involved is frustrated, even if they're not really realizing it.
They have this great trio of songs.
Mm.
There are three songs that just then happen to go together. And the first one belongs to Fredrik, and it's called Now.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, going back to the theme of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
All three of these songs, Now, Later, and Soon, all related to time and revealing where they are in their lives. So Fredrik, talking about Now, he wants to have sex with this girl.
Yeah, and trying to figure out how to
do it.
Make it happen.
Because there's like this uber masculine side of him that thinks I should just take her and ravish her because that is what a man does.
But wait, that wouldn't work.
But then also he's middle aged, and so there are some insecurities that come out.
Yeah,
I love so many of the lyrics in this show that I feel like I
That song has my favorite, which is he's contemplating maybe just sitting in the nude.
Yes.
And he says, that might be effective. My body's all right, but not in perspective and not in the light. Which, again, me. same. It's so good.
Because, once again, he's feeling this pressure, for lack of a better word, to be a man. And
yeah.
But then at the same time showing, but am I good enough?
Yeah.
You know,
like,
I love that.
Well, and also they're both deeply, deeply aware of the age difference. And mm-hmm. she calls him dear old Frederick all the time. Yeah.
So he decides to take a nap instead.
Yes.
Like any middle-aged man.
Might as well nap. Yeah.
Like, this isn't going to happen. I'm stressed out. I'm just going to take a nap.
Yeah.
So he's trying to take a nap. Meanwhile, his son, Henrik, is practicing his cello.
Being angsty with a cello.
Yeah. Oh, why don't we do more of that?
Angsty cello moments, people. We need more of those.
Let's channel our angst and anger into string instruments.
He also, there's something very, the way you hold a cello and do things with it, and the way he's sitting with it, you could look into that somehow.
That's true.
I'm just going to say that.
That's a good point.
There's something about it, and then that song also has that big crescendo, which sounds climactic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, there's a lot.
Someone thought about that when they crafted it.
Wait, are you telling me this show's about sex?
No, it's a cello.
Okay.
Jeffrey, I'm just talking about that cello.
Okay, I'm sorry. So because he's practicing the cello, Anne, very protective of her sleeping husband, because at least then she doesn't have to have sex with him, runs out and says, Henrik, stop with all of that racket. Stop with playing your cello.
Yeah.
Do it later.
Yes.
Which then brings in his song, which is how everyone's always telling him later. It seems like he's just waiting to become something, but he doesn't know what it is. And nobody else seems to know what it is either. And yet they all expect him to be it.
Well, he has so many questions, but he feels like everyone just goes later. Go away. You're an annoying kid.
Mm-hmm.
Which I recognize growing up and feeling like that, too. So
my favorite lyric in this song, because I've felt this so often, as I've often stated, it's intolerable being tolerated.
It's so good.
Screw tolerance.
Yeah, I want to be accepted and loved.
It's intolerable being tolerated.
Yeah.
Okay, so then that gives way to Anne solo, which is called Soon.
Soon, I promise. Yeah.
Which is gorgeous. She's a soprano.
It's such a beautiful song.
Now, let's talk about her, because Sondheim, as great as he is, his cynicism comes through most with his ingenue characters.
Yes.
He very rarely makes them as well-rounded as everyone else.
Okay. Keep going. I'm curious.
I think I see what you're saying. For example,
Joanna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Joanna, it's almost like, you know, sometimes when we look at Romeo and Juliet, we're like, they're so stupid.
Yeah.
You know, when they completely forgot about everything.
Yeah.
We stop being smart human beings when we fall so passionately in love with people. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that there's a thread of that always with his lovers in his stories. I mean, going back to Follies, there's something sad about seeing the lovers so innocently and earnestly connecting with each other, knowing how they're going to end up.
Yeah,
later.
There's a comment on how that will not last.
Yeah, there's the inevitability of
it breaking apart.
Of nothing lasts, nothing stays gold.
Yeah.
You know? So I was trying to think, okay, and Anne is kind of a silly character. She's a silly person. I don't want to say she's a silly character, but she starts
out definitely as a frivolous person who is very surface level.
Mm-hmm.
She talks mostly about earrings and clothes and everything. That's
right.
True.
And then you sent me a clip of Laura Benanti playing her, and Laura
Benanti.
Is that how
you say it? If she's listening.
I've always said Benanti.
She has to explain it every time.
Oh, really? Benanti?
Whenever we talk. Yeah, no. It's Benanti. Yeah. She's like, banana. Yeah.
Oh,
I heard an interview with her where she explained it.
Okay, everyone, stop calling her Benanti.
It's not Benanti. It's Benanti.
So Lara Benanti.
Lara Benanti.
Is such an intelligent actor.
Yeah.
She's always playing these ingenues and then bring like a level of comedy and intelligence that you don't often see.
Mm-hmm.
And you sent me one with Anne, and I was like, oh, this is a different take on the character. Does it still work? Does it work for Anne to be this intelligent and also, you know, the same person who wouldn't sleep with her new husband for 11 months?
I think it does. If you look at Soon as a song, to me it's a song about someone very carefully and kind of knowingly calculating what her place in that world is.
Mm.
I mean, she says, I promise I want to, I won't shy away. And then she gives out all those reasons why it's perfect for them to be together and why she's the perfect wife because she's withholding a little bit.
Because I feel like if I was perfect, then you
tire
wouldn't
of
want me.
But this is someone who's sitting in front of a mirror looking and calculating, again, not in a negative way, what her place in that world is and how she fits into it and what she needs to do to make sure that she doesn't end up doing something she doesn't want to do, which I think is actually pretty smart.
That's great.
Oh.
That's lovely. I love all of
smarter.
Those things. I agree too.
And of course, where she ends up in the show, again, it's not like she suddenly grows up to be Madame Armfelt level intelligence, but she learns something. She has to learn something. So she starts from a specific place and ends up somewhere different.
Yeah.
So it's good.
And when the knight smiles on the fools, she is not one of them.
No, it's the old folks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the middle-aged folks.
Yeah.
After Now, Later, Soon, we meet Desiree Armfelt, right?
Yes.
And
we've talked about her a little bit, and Frederick accidentally says her name when he's napping,
which sends
Anne into a tizzy, because we later find out they've had a tryst. Like, Frederick and Desiree had a whole fling happening before he lost his wife.
And finding Anne.
So there was a little interim time when Frederick and Desiree had a thing going on.
And it almost seems like the one that got away.
Yeah, yeah. But without them realizing it, because they were just in completely different places in their lives.
Absolutely.
And Desiree is an actress who tours around and doesn't stay put.
And the tour that she is currently in is coming to, you know,
wherever they are.
Where in Sweden,
yes.
To the city where Frederick and Anne live.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we meet Desiree, is coming into town to do this, to do her play.
Mm-hmm.
She's a celebrated actor, and The Glamorous Life is the song that kind of introduces her lifestyle,
yes,
which I think is so smart.
It's such a good song.
There's a level of humor to it,
mm-hmm,
because it's called The Glamorous Life, and yet it's revealing how unglamorous it is
Mice
to be an actor.
Mice in the Hallway, Youngish Admirers, which one is that one?
Every time.
Scarfing, like wolfing down a sandwich.
Unpack the luggage, la la la, pack up the luggage, unpack the luggage.
Kind of monotony. And
I sing it in my head every single time I'm out of town, and I'm like, all right, here we go again with the luggage. Am I going to unpack and put it in the hotel room, or maybe I should just live out of the suitcase because it's, you know.
Yeah. It introduces that kind of lifestyle that she's leading, which at the time, with a young daughter out of wedlock, was unusual.
And it's also, most of the things that we hear from her are letters that she's writing to her daughter. And it's always like, I'm so sorry, I'm a terrible mother.
Gotta run.
I think another one of the great themes explored in the show is the sacrifices that one makes in your personal life when you're an artist. You know? Because you're an incredibly talented person.
Thank you.
Everyone that I talk to agrees. And yet you've taken a step back from performing as a profession.
Well, yeah, I mean, I got a day job and then kind of got very seduced by paid vacations and health insurance. I took a step back. I mean, to talk about it personally, there was a long time when I was doing a lot of theater, which was great, but also doesn't pay enough, unfortunately. And
we really struggle that with regional.
Yeah. And so you doesn't pay enough. And I ended up taking a lot of jobs, and some of them I wasn't really that passionate about. So for me personally, and I think everyone does things differently.
Of course.
Personally, for me, when I got the opportunity to step back a little bit, and we're talking about, like, I mean, I've been doing theater for a long time. So for me, later in my life, now that I'm 35, it made more sense for me to step back from it a little bit, which, spoiler alert, is kind of, I think, implicitly what Desiree does by the end of this show. She chooses to maybe be around her family a little bit more. But I don't know, everyone should do whatever makes them happy. But I understand that. I get it.
This is a personal question, but are you happier now?
Yes. Yeah, I am. Yes, of course. Of course. It's not like I don't wish I could do more theater, especially if I could do more projects that I care about.
Yeah.
But absolutely, I'm happier now. I remember specifically a lot of times when I was doing more theater because I had to do it because I didn't have any other source of income besides, like, doing graphic design on the side. That's unrelated. There were a lot of times where I was anxious and felt burnt out and not happy and a little frantic. So
like health insurance.
Yeah, well, it's just like I feel calmer and happier now for sure. But it's nice to be able to still do it.
Yeah,
it's
for sure.
And it feels more special, which is kind of nice.
Oh, that is nice too.
But so I am Desiree Armfeld is what we're trying to say.
Let's move over Vanessa Williams.
The other thing about that song specifically that I think is brilliant is that we learn a lot about her relationships with the people in her life in a very, like, short period of time, because it's one song. You learn so much about her relationship with her daughter and her mother, because that's
tumultuous.
Yeah.
So Madame Armfeld, the older lady, basically took the daughter away from her because she
took her in.
Yeah, she was, the daughter was on tour with her mom, you know, going, living this quote-unquote glamorous life.
Yeah.
And the grandmother made up both of their minds and said, this is not good for her. She's going to come and live with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that right off the bat is a source of, you know, contention. Not to mention that these are two very strong women with a lot of history and are constantly butting heads. So Frederick gets tickets for he and Anne to go see the play.
Yeah.
They're sitting in their box seats. The play is happening. Desiree's on stage and she locks eyes with Frederick.
Mm-hmm.
And
remember,
Anne notices it.
Freaks out.
It, you know, causes even more insecurity because now maybe her plan to, you know, use her sexuality to figure out her life isn't going to last.
No.
You know, it's a ticking time bomb now.
Yeah.
So she creates a scene and makes Frederick take her home.
Yes.
We can then fast forward to, like, I guess we can go to the dressing room then, right?
Yeah, because he takes her home and then leaves.
So he takes her home.
Well, he takes her home and they sort of almost catch Henrik and Petra having their little thing, because while this is happening, Petra is very gamely trying to teach Henrik the ways of, you know, sex and life. And Henrik is trying to make things happen with Petra disastrously. Poor Henrik. Poor Henrik.
Poor
couldn't even
Henrik.
Make that happen.
So then Frederick drops off Anne at home and then goes back to the theater. Mm-hmm. Was it to the theater?
He goes to the theater to Desiree's dressing room for what essentially is the booty call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He shows up. Oh, my gosh. We haven't seen each other in forever. Yes, please sit down. Have a drink. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm married. Oh, really? Then why are you here? Oh, well, but you should meet her. She's wonderful. She's fantastic.
A great song.
And this is a true scene song. You know, it's wonderful. Yeah. He reveals, she's fantastic, she's wonderful, but also we haven't had sex yet. We've been married a year.
Record scratch.
Right? Are you kidding me? She's a monster.
Mm-hmm.
To cut to the end.
They essentially like, how about giving me one for all time's
sake?
Yeah,
so for all time's sake, do you mind if we have sex?
Yep.
And she's like, absolutely, what are friends for?
Yeah. Again, who amongst us hasn't had that situation happen to them?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so as he has told her that he's married, she tells him, I'm not married, but I am sleeping with this guy who is married. And
he's a dragoon.
And he's this military guy. He's basically Gaston.
Yeah. Basically, it's the same character.
And it's this really bizarre side of chivalry where he almost feels like he's doing everyone a favor by having both a wife and a mistress.
Yeah.
These women are pitiful and poor, and look, I'm allowing them both to suck my
and a weird, yes, amongst other things, I hope. And this weird, like, double standard of if one of them ever tries to cheat on me, boy,
exactly.
Very strange, like,
strange
morality.
Strange double standard.
Yes.
So he comes back into town right after they've finished. I don't know if they finished.
They don't tell us. This isn't Passion. We don't see them fucking in the beginning, so we just don't know.
I mean, what are we in, 1994?
Yeah, times were simpler in the 70s.
So he comes into the dressing room, catches them both in robes. They have to create this crazy story as to why they're naked.
Why he's in a robe wearing his nightshirt, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So the story that they come up with is that since he's a lawyer, he's always been Madame Armfelt, the mother's lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He came to get some papers signed. He falls into the bath. So then he has to get out of his wet clothes in order for them to dry. And that's why he's there, and that's why they're naked. And meanwhile, you know, the what is his name? So we can just call him by his name.
Malcolm. Magnus. He's got like five names. Magnus, Malcolm, Count Olaf Schmolaf. I don't know. Jorgen Schmorgen. I know that it's Malcolm.
Yeah.
Call Magnus.
Call
Magnus.
Is it?
No, I'm exactly right.
Okay.
Yes. Call Magnus Malcolm.
Okay. So Carl Magnus, CM. Carl Magnus, he doesn't believe it for 1 second.
He just kind of he buys it, sort of.
He buys it enough to, I think, have sex with her.
Well,
right?
No, what ends up happening is he asks the lawyer to leave. He's like, well, I'm here now, so you can go.
Yeah, so he does, and then he stays with her. I'm like,
well,
now I'm thinking about, like, poor Desiree, man. Whew.
Oh, she's doing fine. I mean, she doesn't care. In the Bergman movie, it's very clear that she thinks the whole thing is hilarious.
Oh, okay.
Also, even in the musical, if I'm not mistaken, there's that great moment where she brings out his clothes and they're soaking wet. And it's like, why did you have to soak my clothes?
Right.
This was
you're really selling the story.
We were lying.
To my detriment.
Yeah.
It isn't helping anybody.
God bless.
The next thing we see is Carl Magnus going home to his wife, right?
Yeah, because he's married to Charlotte Malcolm.
Who we all love. I love me some Charlotte.
Because she's just dry as bones.
She's dry.
Sassy.
Yeah.
Smart.
And you're like, why on earth would you be cheating on this woman? She seems like everything.
She's amazing. Well, and by the end of the show, he kind of realizes it thanks to her machinations. But
sure.
She deserves better than him, that's for sure.
But he sings his song that's...
It's called In Praise of Women, and it's basically just him like... rationalizing women's place in the world while also obsessing about what the heck was going on in that room. Why was a lawyer there? He mentioned papers. Where were the papers? She couldn't do that to me. She wouldn't do that to me. Blah, blah, blah. Just very toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Hashtag toxic masculinity.
Exactly. Who says this show isn't relevant?
Hello.
No one.
No one.
He tells his wife what went down. It's really interesting that they have, it's like an open
marriage. It's an open relationship.
But only open from one side.
Yes, exactly.
He tells her exactly what went down.
Yeah.
She's like, oh no, that's terrible, because my little sister's best friend in school was Anne,
mm-hmm.
you know, the new wife.
Yeah.
So I should probably go have lunch with her and let her know so that she finds out from someone who cares about her instead of some, you know, gossip.
Exactly. Mill. Even though really she's spilling the tea, but
yeah,
sure.
But
sure.
I mean, no. They go to lunch. She tells Anne about the hip bath.
The hip bath.
And Anne is, you know, devastated, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Which allows Charlotte also the opportunity to finally open up about
how she feels about her marriage.
She is about her own marriage,
yeah.
and her life. And they both sing Every Day a Little Death.
We're getting redundant, but it's such a good song.
It is.
I think the most beautiful song in the score. Also, this is a tangent, but one of three songs in the score that are a deceptive waltz. It doesn't sound like a waltz.
Mm, he got very creative.
Yeah, this song. Weirdly enough, Now, the first song, and Weekend in the Country are all songs that if you just listen to them sound like they're in 4-4. But if you actually look at the sheet music, it's in 6-8, and it doesn't sound like a waltz, but it is. It's crazy. Sondheim's crazy.
What I love about Every Day a Little Death is that it's a song about love and marriage, and yet it's called Every Day a Little Death.
Well, and fun fact, a little death in French means orgasm. In case you're wondering. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Le petit mort is what the French call an orgasm.
Is a little death.
Yeah.
Wow.
Again, it's a show.
Oh my gosh. Sometimes the French drive me crazy.
Well, me too.
Get over yourself.
Those French.
So pretentious.
I know. I hope no one French is listening to this. We love you, France. Yeah, le petit mort.
I mean, I'll go to a bakery anytime.
We'll go to, you know what? We'll go to Au Bon Pain. we'll still go there.
I have a Le Pain Quotidien right next to me.
Bread a day. Yeah.
But it's beautiful because it's talking about how, I mean, we hurt each other in marriage. All the little ways that kind of chip away at our souls,
mm-hmm.
when we open ourselves up to being loved.
And as a married man, I can assure you that is true.
But, and to quote Next Normal, like, that's the price of love, but we pay it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Is Next Normal basically the same musical as Little Night Music? Discuss. Has Alice Ripley played Desiree Armfeld?
Alice would be amazing.
She'd be great.
Yeah.
I'm sure she's done it.
I wanted
she's
to see,
it.
For a long time, I just really wanted to see Emily Skinner as Petra.
Oh! She still could.
You think she could still do
it? I think she could. Petra, well, no, she has to be a specific age, you're right.
That would be another great Armfeld.
Emily's, yeah. Well, they could alternate and no one would notice the difference if they do it right.
Yeah,
because they still get confused for each other all the time.
Well, maybe Vanessa wouldn't want to do the full 8 shows.
Vanessa probably wouldn't. She's busy.
So maybe Emily would take over, you know, matinees like Donna
Murphy.
We're now
having 3 different people play. It's a great role. It needs 3 different people. Has Rachel York ever done it?
No,
I don't know. Because the Desiree and the Bergman movie looks exactly like Rachel York.
Really?
And that's all I could think about the entire time.
Just like 7 feet tall.
7 feet tall, her face with like that great strong jaw. I don't know.
Okay.
Welcome to Casting Desiree, a podcast by Jeffrey Scott Parsons and Tom Zohar.
This makes me happy. Okay, Every Day a Little Death ends. Then, we skipped Liaisons.
No, we didn't, did we?
Mm-hmm.
It happens before Every Day a Little Death?
Mm-hmm.
It does.
It happens as they're getting busy in the dressing room.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, so
okay.
When they're having their liaison, then old lady Madame Armfeld comes out in her chair to talk about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
Because of how people fall in love these days.
Sex used to be this fun way to move up in the world.
Yeah, it used to be transactionary, and now everybody's falling in love when they have sex.
And it was so much better when it was transactionary and you ended up with a mansion and all the lovers that she's had, which actually the way that she describes it sounds really fun, so good for her.
It's also really fun to just hear an old lady like that. Because you would think that somebody like that would be stodgy and you know, rigid about morals. And
that's what's great about her character. She's like, no, y'all are being too serious about this.
Yeah.
Like, just have sex and get what you need out of it. It's a pleasurable means to a measurable end. Like,
I saw the Catherine Zeta-Jones revival, or should I say the Angela Lansbury revival, where Angela Lansbury was playing Madame Armfeldt and was a total masterclass.
Oh, yeah.
You know, talk about someone who's just completely in control of their craft. And
yeah.
And it was just a joy to watch somebody like that work on stage.
Sure.
Here's the thing, though. The song Liaisons is when I'm reminded that, like, I'm a small town boy because my mind always wanders.
Like, it's okay.
I will be sitting there and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to really pay attention to this song this time. And every single time my mind just goes, whoop.
Jeffrey, you're not alone.
Away.
Don't feel bad, please. But honestly, though, like, it never ends. And then suddenly it does because she literally falls asleep because
yeah.
she's bored.
Exactly. I mean, it knows. It's self-aware enough to,
yeah.
to know that she keeps getting lost in
where
her thoughts.
Where was I? Yeah.
But he rhymed liaisons with raisins. And you know what? Kudos. Kudos.
So smart. Okay. The original Madame Armfeldt was Hermione Gingold, who is reticent. She's the original, you know, Mayor Shin's wife in the film version of Music Man. And is, you know, kind of pure camp. Who she is in one role is who she is in every role.
Yeah. The personality.
And hilarious and, you know, body in a way. In her very British way. And she really wanted to come in for the production, and Sondheim thought she was completely wrong for it. Based on her type and her
career.
She's a little
character-y.
Yeah. We're supposed to believe this woman was a courtesan, you know?
Yeah.
And a courtesan shot. And
Jeffrey, are you proud?
That's funny.
This makes you proud.
Anyway, but he let her, you know, he's like, all right, well, but she's who she is. She should absolutely come in an audition.
Yeah.
She comes into audition. She doesn't have a song prepared. And they're like, oh, well, you're going to need to sing. Sondheim wrote 5 of these songs in rehearsals. So he didn't have a full score because he wanted to know who the actors were. He said, okay, I'm going to at least need to hear you sing something so I know your range. So she sang this old
musical.
Yeah. So she sang this old music hall song that was very charming. And then she did the scenes, which were very charming, but he still didn't think that she was right.
Mm.
And she goes, thank you all for letting me. Actually, I'm going to read it.
Read it, please. I want to know.
It's so perfect. She thanked us for allowing her to audition against our better judgment. Not that anyone had told her such a thing. She had merely assumed we would think her wrong for the part. She then added, I noticed that in the script, Madame Armfeldt is 74 years old. Coincidentally, gentlemen, so am I. I also noticed that when she dies at the end, the stage direction indicates that her wig slips a bit off her head. Well... And with that, she lifted off her wig, revealing herself to be completely bald. As the clang of 3 jaws hitting the floor died away, she thanked us once again and left the stage. And we decided to give her the part before she left the theater.
Ladies and gentlemen, she literally snatched her wig off.
And there wasn't another wig underneath.
Right. Drag race queens who do it now owe it all to Hermione Gingold. That's right.
Isn't that phenomenal?
That's the best story I've ever heard.
And
I'm going to start doing that. Even though I don't have a wig, I'll get one. I don't care.
We're getting into A Weekend in the Country, which is the Act 1 finale.
Which is the best Act 1 closer before Defying Gravity. There was Weekend in the Country, and there was Defying Gravity. I saw a production of Little Night Music where I gave them a standing ovation and intermission because of how good their Weekend in the Country was. So, yeah, shout out Signet Theater.
I'm so happy to hear that.
I'll name them. It's fine.
We love them. Yeah. We have so many friends.
Yes.
Weekend in the Country, Desiree decides that... Basically, Frederick would be a great father for his daughter.
Well, she realizes that her daughter needs a father figure and that she actually would really like to maybe settle down with a man, which good for her.
Yeah, good for her. So she talks to her mom and says, hey, let's invite Frederick and Anne up for the weekend and I'll get my claws in there and then everything will live happily ever after.
Yes.
So they send out invitations to Frederick and Anne. Anne receives the invitation and of course she's already feeling insecure about Desiree.
Yes.
And now I have to spend an entire weekend with her knowing that there's this thing between them.
And Petra's really excited about it, so she doesn't understand what the hell is wrong with Anne, but she just doesn't want to do it.
By the way, when was like this weird pillow fight between Petra and Anne that almost feels like they could make out at any
second. So it happens in the Bergman movie also.
Yeah.
And in the Bergman movie, they are full on under the covers, and then she kind of kisses her and leaves. I don't remember exactly when it happens.
It's early. It's in the first act, though,
right? It's early in the show, yeah.
Petra's just, like, getting her kicks whenever she...
Petra
like
doesn't
you
care.
Said, sex positive.
Petra is sex positive, possibly bisexual. Bisexual icon, I'll call it. no, I mean, actually, she's... I love her because she's just like... Whatever, I'm just having fun. It's exciting to someone like her.
Which is kind of cool that someone in her position, we would basically call her the help, is living life to her its fullest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So she gets the invitation. She's freaking out.
Which is when she goes to Charlotte and goes, look at this ridiculous thing. I'm not going. And Charlotte is like,
You should absolutely go because you're going to be up against a middle-aged woman. Like, he's going to see how beautiful you are. And, you know, old Desiree is just going to keep withering.
Wear your hair down in a flower. Don't use makeup. Dress in white. She'll grow older by the hour and be hopelessly shattered by Saturday night, which is,
Sondheim
I don't know how you get
than I could
better
do
than
it.
That. Yeah.
And so then she's like, okay. Well, then
good
we're
plan.
Going.
Yeah.
Charlotte tells...
Carl Magnus. Who is shooting.
Babe, you should probably know that this woman that you're really possessive about has just invited Frederick up to his house for the weekend. Carl Magnus says, well, then we're going too. And she's like, we weren't invited. And he said, we're going. And she's like, oh, crap.
I know. Like, that backfired.
Yeah, that was not what I was expecting. So now they're all going to the country for the weekend.
The country.
And it sets up the second act beautifully. We're so excited to come back from intermission.
Oh, it's so good.
Okay, so when I saw in New York, once again, this revival, I was in standing room. And so I have this really fun memory of my feet were killing me from walking around all day. And then I was standing for all of Little Night Music. Ugh. And so I like quietly took my shoes off and...
Jeff, for listeners, I'm just gawking at him for doing that. Go ahead.
But they were like really easy on and off type shoes. And I was just like, oh my gosh, my poor flat feet. And then like, I knew Weekend in the Country so well that I was like, okay, when it reaches this point, that's when I need to start putting on my shoes. So when the lights came up for, you know, intermission, that I was like, this is wonderful.
This is just lovely.
Isn't this just the most elegant, refined
that I'm
evening?
Wearing? So good. Do you take your shoes off on airplanes?
No.
Okay, good. Thank you. I had a moment where I was like, Jeffrey, where else do you take your shoes off?
I'm not that person.
You're
in
not
fact,
that girl. Fun fact, I can't type shoelaces very well. It takes me like a full 15 minutes. So I prefer slip-ons. So usually the shoes I wear don't. I can slip it on and off. So I get it, Jeff. It's fine. You took your shoes off. It's a weekend in the country. They're not wearing shoes.
They're not. I also remember Catherine Zeta-Jones making her big entrance for Glamorous Life and me thinking, oh, yeah, that's a star.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I
mean? Especially the costume they gave her, that black, like, ugh.
Like, she walked in and I was just like, I don't know if I had ever quite had that rush over me before. And... I mean, she was fine in the show. Like, I didn't think she was the best Desiree
Poor thing
I've
was
ever
so
seen.
Sick at the Tonys. Like, I was watching her going, she is nervous.
Yeah. But, yeah, you can't really teach star power, and she had it.
I'll tweet her, just in case. Yeah, I'll reach out to Kathy. I'll be like, Kathy.
Hey, Kat.
Yo, C dog.
Hey, CZ.
CZJ.
CZJ.
Hey, CZJ.
Oh, my gosh. I would love to call Catherine Zeta-Jones CZJ.
Yo, CZJ, what you up to, girl? What's up?
All right, so act two starts.
Yes.
And we're out at the country.
Yes, and the group of singers is discussing the fact that the sun refuses to set.
Because it's Sweden. It probably is kind of true. I don't know.
It's a thing that happens.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know all the details about it. Do at me if you know more details about it. But there's at least one night a year or a few years, I don't know when the sun won't really set. It just kind of dips down and then rises again. So it's perpetual.
It's smiling.
Perpetual. It smiles three times. Perpetual sunset.
One of the first songs in the second act is for Carl Magnus and Frederick, and they're singing about Desiree, and how she's kind of their perfect woman.
Boy, do I skip this song every time I listen to it.
That's okay.
Men singing, I'm just like, okay.
I feel the same way.
You know what I mean? It's just like, okay. Well, I'm glad you're singing men by.
Like, no, there was a time in my life when I looked at my iTunes store and I was so embarrassed by how gay it looked that I was like, all right, I need to buy something that besides Alice Ripley... I mean, truly, because I just had Alice Ripley and Emily Skinner's albums.
Good.
And I was like, okay, what can I do? So I bought Seal and Bon Jovi.
Jeffrey, you went all the way to the other side of the spectrum. Bon Jovi, that's a choice. But also,
is it really?
No, now that you mention it, I'm like, that's also pretty clear.
I mean, it's kind of, it's like a 40-year-old woman who's like, I love Seal.
You went from gay boy to 40-year-old woman. We stan, honestly. I like that progression for you very much.
That gives way to, look, I love a good dinner party scene.
Yes.
And this one has a great dinner party scene.
This one is mystical. It's magical.
It is.
It's comical.
In the newest revival, they all sat on pillows, which
weird.
I thought was an interesting choice.
Not right, but
I'm
okay.
Like, I'm like, Madame Armfeld doesn't own a dining
table.
It's
supposed to be sumptuous, but sure. It's so funny. I also love that it's in the movie and in every production I've seen, it's set so that Madame Armfeld is sitting in front of a whole row of everyone else, which is such a power play from Madame Armfeld.
It is. You're right.
Screw y'all's conversation. I'm presiding.
I am presiding here. You're exactly right.
I have the special wine, by the way, with magical properties.
Nobody knows quite what it is.
Okay, in the Bergman movie, she gives the ingredients.
Oh.
Are you ready?
I can't wait.
It's a drop of mother's milk and a drop of the seed from a stallion. Yummy!
Speechless.
Yes.
I've never been so grateful to be sober in my life.
I am, au contraire, I want that in every juice I drink.
Put
it in my thermos. Yes.
So our favorite vocalists come out and sing Perpetual Anticipation.
Yes.
Which is good for the heart, good for the soul.
Good for the soul, but bad for the heart. Which I kind of understand. Anyone with anxiety gets that.
In this dinner party, mm-hmm. Charlotte starts flirting big time with Frederick to try and make her husband.
Which is part of the plan that Desiree and Charlotte have about breaking that whole thing up.
Because Desiree doesn't want Carl Magnus anymore.
No, she just wants
Frederick, but like for realsies.
Do they have a moment in the musical? Because I know they do in the movie, but in the musical, do they have a moment where they talk to each other about how, hey, I know we're enemies, but let's work together?
I think so.
Yeah.
I can't remember. But I think you're right. As you said it, I was like, yes, absolutely, they have this plan.
It's also great. It's two strong women who don't get along being like, you know what? Screw our rivalry. Let's work together.
Right.
Women.
So Charlotte gets super drunk and is flirting with Frederick the entire time, which is just pissing off her husband to no
end. Carl Magnus is having a bad dinner. Yeah.
Yeah. As though, like, she's embarrassing herself. And it's
right.
Like, dude, you're embarrassing.
You're the embarrassing one.
But Frederick is like, oh, you're just delightful.
You just think it's funny.
Yeah. Henrik.
Speaking of embarrassing. Has had enough.
Exactly.
Of grown-ups and their bullshittery.
So he stands up and just kind of yells at everybody and has a breakdown.
Yeah.
Like, emotional breakdown, and then runs out of the room.
It smashes a glass. Yes, and then runs out of the room.
Carl Magnus, this is actually kind of an interesting thing. So Carl Magnus finally decides that he's going to find out the truth between these two,
mm-hmm.
and asks the old lady, Madame Armfeld, is Frederick actually your lawyer? Because I have heard that he has come here several times and is a friend of Desiree's, you know,
mm-hmm.
to finally get to the truth of what's going on. And Madame Armfeld basically says, I haven't been paying attention to any of this conversation because you all are boring.
Legend.
And,
legend.
And then introduces the dessert wine and then leaves the stage.
She's a legend. She's
so
a Kwan.
She is a Kwan.
She's an actual Kwan.
Thank you.
Yeah. So dinner is a disaster.
So, yeah, dinner's a total disaster.
Yeah.
Anne's also upset because of Henrik. She tries to go after him. Frederick gets mad.
Mm-hmm.
Anne has this, like, kind of tender feelings toward Henrik as well. That you start seeing.
Yeah.
She cares about him and is worried about him.
Well, she's in love with him. She just doesn't quite realize it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then the dinner scene The dinner scene comes to an end, mm-hmm. thank goodness, because otherwise somebody would have been stabbed.
That a table would have been flipped on Madame Armfeldt or the other way around, for right. all we know. Yes.
Maybe that's why there wasn't a table in the revival.
Because she would have flipped it.
Because there's no other choice.
Desiree's like, we know that Mother has a penchant for flipping tables, so we're going to just not bother with it at this point.
The next big scene is between Frederick and Desiree. They kind of have a DTR, determine the relationship.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like it.
Mm-hmm. And Frederick basically says, I need to be true to my wife.
Yeah. I'm happy where I am, he mm-hmm. says.
And yeah. this scene originally was Frederick's scene. And so Sondheim was planning on writing a song for him. And then the more that they thought about it, they realized that Desiree had two songs in the first act, both of which were duets. And so this was really the moment to give her a solo.
Mm-hmm.
And Glynis Johns was the original Desiree Armfeldt, yeah. also known as Sister Suffragette from Mary Poppins.
Best off the shackles of yesterday.
I mean, talk about icon. Love her so much.
Yes.
And so much of the role is built around her skill set.
And she can carry a tune, but certainly it's not.
She has a very raspy but light voice.
Sondheim calls it silvery, which I find interesting.
Yeah. And so knowing her voice and what she was capable of, specifically in terms of breath support, because her tone is kind of whispered and raspy, he decided that the song should have short phrases,
mm-hmm.
and short phrases could be questions. Like, that's a really
Isn't
easy way.
Isn't it rich? Mm-hmm. So you don't have to hold it. Are we a pair? So
and
you don't
so
have
one,
to hold it.
So once he realized all of that, he said the Send in the Clowns, which is probably one of his most popular songs, most successful songs.
I think
songs.
It's boring as hell. I'm just kidding. just kidding.
But it's certainly a song that, from a pop culture standpoint.
Barbara did it. Frank Sinatra did it. Yeah. Who hasn't done it? Yeah.
Judy Collins uh-huh. was one of the people who recorded it, I think, 2 years after it premiered on Broadway
mm-hmm.
and won the Grammy Award for Song of the Year.
Good.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
So I don't know of any other... I mean, certainly since then, any other song from a musical
that became popular
that won a Grammy Award for Song of the Year.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So this was the song that he wrote for her. And
full-on acting song.
At the same time, I think on some level when I was younger, I was trying to figure out why were we talking about clowns? Like, it seemed like such an interesting...
I mean, if I'm not mistaken, that's like an old-timey stage thing of like, if something falters on stage, when in doubt, just send in the clowns.
Right.
So that it's what's happening is this this actress who is very in touch with herself and knows what she's doing and very calculated in her actions and always got a quip or like a way of dealing with awkward situations has found herself in a situation where she doesn't know her lines. She doesn't know how to get out of it. She's out of quips, and she's going, well, I guess I've just hit a wall here, and I don't know what to do next, so someone help me and send in the clowns. And while saying that, she's realizing, wait, where are the clowns? We're the dummos here.
And isn't that brilliant? Because it goes right back to the theme of the summer night smiles at the young,
the fools.
And then the fools.
Exactly.
And I think that as I grew older and got to know the show better, I'm like, oh, that's why they're clowns.
Yeah.
From there... Do we go to Petra and
Is that
Freed?
When Petra and Freed have their little tourist in the grass?
Let's talk about it now.
Freed gets a line, finally. He gets a line, and it's something very poetic, and Freed's character...
Oh, I don't know if we've even talked about him at this point. He's the butler.
Oh, we're going to talk about Freed.
He's the butler for...
He wheels Armfeldt around.
Yeah.
He is always, in every situation I've ever seen of any production of it, the hottest person in the cast. Basically, when they look for a Freed, they go, oh, are you 6 feet tall and muscular? Cool. Because he doesn't have to sing, and he doesn't have to really say that much. He has, like, literally one line. All you have to do is roll around with Petra in the grass, normally shirtless, normally in suspenders, like Skimble Shanks in the movie. Always hot.
If I remember correctly, on your old Tinder profile, it said preferred type Freed.
Yeah. It's actually, I still say it to anyone who'd hear. It doesn't matter if I'm married or not.
Okay. The little tryst with Freed ends in a song for Petra.
Well, and so what happens is when they show up at the mansion for the Weekend of the Country, Petra, as any smart person would do, looks for whatever's around for her to have some fun with.
I'm going to say that there are a lot of my listeners who would probably say, I have never done that.
Well, some of you have. Jeffries, you're welcome to cut
and I
this
just,
out.
And I just want to be the voice of those people.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's the devil talking to you and an angel sitting across from him. Jeffrey, I'm trying to appeal to your more jaded listeners.
Yeah, no, I get it. Like, because heaven knows I've talked about church and love so
which
much
we
on
love.
This podcast.
I'm here to talk about hell and sex. Two things Jews don't believe in. Listen, sex positivity is important, joking aside.
Yes.
And I think Petra is, that's kind of what I love about her as a character.
And then she has a song that is as much as raucous as she is, but also has a twinge of melancholy.
Yeah.
And I think it's so, it's
it
it's
ends on
really
a
beautiful.
Minor every time.
Mm-hmm. So she talks about one day she's going to marry, you know, a successful man.
She's going through a roster, basically, of all the people that she would love to marry someday.
But then after she talks about this man that she's going to marry, she just says, in the meanwhile I'm going to, you know, have my fun.
Sondheim opens up his thesaurus and just finds all the alliterations that you could possibly find in a patter song.
It's a very short road from the pinch and the punch to the paunch and the pouch and the pension.
I mean, guys.
It's a very short road to the 10,000th lunch and the belch and the grouch and the sigh.
I mean.
Ugh.
I mean.
It's so good.
Peh. Just like all the pez.
Yeah.
And the woman who gets cast as Petra runs away with the show. Just one song. It's like Fontaine. You run away with the show. And if you're good enough, you may not even put it back. Like, you may just run away with it forever.
It's mine.
It's mine.
Why do you think it is sad?
Why do I think it ends on a melancholy note?
Yeah, because every time she is talking about, you know, marriage, it keeps going back to that minor key.
Again, I know I talk about it a lot. I'm going to go back to the movie because in the movie, it's a lot more explicit that this is a woman who wants to get married. I think, honestly, part of it is because she actually wants to get married.
Mm.
And she's thinking about all the fun she's having. But every time she reaches the end of those moments, it goes back to a minor note because she realizes, but at the end of the day, here's what I'm actually looking for.
Because up until this point, we've just known her as
kind of like
the sassy horny maid.
Yeah.
Sex positive maid, excuse
me. Thank you.
Me.
No, you're good.
And but then to at least identify the fact that it's not completely satisfying.
No.
Is what makes it a well-rounded character.
And she ends up marrying at the end of the movie. At the Bergman
does she?
Movie? Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's a little different from what happens during the musical.
All right. So after Petra stole in the show, we then go to Henrik, who has decided to end his life.
Yes.
And kind of walks in on his suicide a little bit.
And I'm going to be talking about the movie. This is the actual last time.
Okay.
And this one is important.
Okay.
Very important. In the movie, Henrik is staying in a room that is kind of like their quote-unquote presidential suite, but there's a secret to this room. It's a room adjoining another bedroom. There is a secret button inside of this room that if you press it, a part of the wall opens up.
Oh, stop it.
The bed from the other room slides in. The wall closes again. The figure, the little statue of a trumpeter angel comes out of the wall and trumpets. It is essentially a booty call button, which is insane, hilarious, and horrifying when you consider the implications of how little consent there is about a bed just sliding into a room.
It's a little Matt Lauer.
Thank you. In the movie, what happens is Henrik goes to hang himself in his room. He tries to hang himself off of like a light or something, like fixture. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what. It breaks. He falls down and hits his chest against the button. He didn't realize the button was there. A bed slides into the room. Anne is in that bed. That is how they end up together. So with all due respect to Sondheim and the forest scene, that is one thing from the movie I wish they put into the musical because it's insane.
That's insane.
Yep.
I'm a huge fan of secret passages in homes.
It's so magical.
It's like, it's a non-negotiable for me. When I have a house as a, you know, a grown-up.
I want that for you as a grown-up. It's weird. I'm talking to a five-year-old.
Yeah,
you sound so adult.
There has to be a secret passage of some kind.
But also, can you imagine if they put in a musical and every production had to build a set piece with
God
a
bless
bed?
Those community theaters. That's like...
They would just have like a person in black. Like,
no, we have to install a hydraulic system for the bed to come out of the stage.
So
for a little
good.
Night music that's not going to sell.
Oh, God.
Anne interrupts the suicide in the forest.
He Dear Evan Hansen's it, which means he falls out of a tree and kind of botches his...
Mm-hmm. And actually, Sondheim... wanted the suicide to be successful.
What?
I mean, that's how dark Sondheim likes to go.
That's not even how the story goes.
All right. And Hugh Wheeler was like, no, like, this is a happy, this is a happy
Sondheim.
Show.
Sondheim.
So, but anyway, in the musical, thank goodness, he doesn't
go through
with it.
Yeah, he doesn't die.
He doesn't. In fact, it allows him to finally reveal his feelings to Anne, that he has loved her a long time,
and she's like, oh my God, same.
Something clicks in her, and she's like, oh, wow, this is what I've been waiting for. Mm-hmm. And they do it.
And they literally run away.
Yeah.
No word to anyone. They're just like, bye.
Yeah.
We're done.
So that's when the night smiles on the young because they find each other and run away.
How's there ever been a production where there is like a smile projection? I'm going to do that. In a little night rock music, there will be a projection of a smile.
The toothy grin of the, the Swedish moon.
It gets bigger and bigger as it goes along. The Swedish moon. I like that.
Then the next thing that happens is the duel, right?
There's the duel. Yes, it happens after that because Frederick is like bereft about his bride escaping.
Yes, he's like, where has Anne gone?
Mm-hmm. And Carl Magnus is like, what did you do with my wife? Blah, blah, blah. We're going to play a Russian roulette.
High stakes.
Yeah.
I don't know. These rich people are really bored. So they play Russian roulette. Mm-hmm. The gun goes off, but it luckily just grazes his ear.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's like...
On the ground. Double bereft
right.
at this point.
Desiree runs to him.
Yes.
Right.
Like, oh, you fool. Yeah, literally. Yeah. She's just like, and she's like, oh, I've been such a fool. And he realizes how idiotic.
And sometimes we do need a little taste
slap
of
in
death
the face.
An actual slap
in the face from death. Uh-huh. They sing a reprise.
They sing the reprise of Send in the Clowns, which is we've been clowns all this time.
Yeah, merry-go-round, me as King Lear, which is a nice lyric. I like it.
That is sweet. Mm-hmm. And so the knight smiles on the fools. There they are.
The last one.
And then Carl Magnus realizes, I think, that Charlotte is worth more.
Oh, he doesn't realize shit. What happens is she goes, Carl Magnus, turn around and look at me. Uh-huh. And she gives him what for?
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm your wife, blah, 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 blah. Which, again, she deserves better, but good for her for asserting herself.
I'm glad that she stands up for herself.
I think they last another 5 months and then she goes, okay.
Yeah, enough is enough.
We're done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of the feeling I get as well.
Yes.
Then I don't know if... We've known this before, but we realize that Desiree's daughter's name is Frederica.
Yeah, Frederica, which...
So then Frederick's like, oh, shoot, this is my kid?
Yeah, it's his kid.
So we see them together as a family, as they should be.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think I'm really excited for them.
They will last. I think they'll be okay.
Yeah.
I think they'll be okay.
They know how to fight in the right way.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then years later, Frederica will write a searing memoir about how damaging it's all been for her. A mommy dearest.
Go full Carrie Fisher.
Abso-friggin-lutely.
Then R.I.P. Carrie Fisher.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of R.I.P., guess what's about to happen?
So the last thing that needs to happen is for the knight to smile on the old.
Mm-hmm.
And Frederica, the daughter, tells her grandma...
you told me that you knight would smile three times. It's
exactly.
only been two times.
It's only been twice. What's the third one?
Yeah.
And Madame Armfield like takes a deep breath.
She goes, watch this!
Right?
Dies.
And then dies. And the music is gorgeous.
Her wig apparently falls off a little bit.
Just a little bit.
She snatches one last wig.
As a true icon, she... Look... Is there a more iconic character who can call her own death and it's a peaceful death?
Uh-huh.
Where she's just like...
She just goes blip.
She just gives up the ghost and she good.
She good. That's, she's like, peace.
My work here is done.
If I don't die in a wheelchair with a wig falling off peacefully, I just revive me and let me try again.
With Jonathan Tunick orchestrations to accompany you.
Yeah, that's a dream.
That's great.
It's a dream.
And the show ends with everyone waltzing with the partners that they should have had.
And then Frederica looks in the audience and goes, and haven't we all had a little night music blackout? No, I just wish every show ended like that.
Where you have to say the title.
Like the title, yeah.
Make eye contact with every audience member.
Yes.
I've been recording a lot of episodes about family shows. Yeah. You know, like Frozen and
this one will need to have a little E next to it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the reasons why it was so refreshing for audiences and from the reviews I read from critics, they were saying, oh, it's a musical written for adults.
Yeah.
And not like...
Not meaning that it's bawdy or dirty.
Not that it's dirty.
Not that those are fine too.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah, but that's not what they meant. They were meaning sophisticated and also adult themes.
The themes are not frivolous.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's very grown up.
Yeah, and it's something that you have to sit and listen to.
Yeah,
you have to be an engaged audience member to really enjoy it in the way that it's meant to be enjoyed.
Where some musicals are ice cream, this one's like a parfait, like at a, like a.
It's meant to be. It's meant to be nibbled and enjoyed over several hours. Sometimes I just like down. I don't even taste it. I'm just like
when I eat. You can ask my husband. It's just I open up like a snake, and the burrito just goes down, and then I suffer later. But
sure,
I don't think about suffering in the moment.
Yeah,
because life is short.
Because it's a very short road.
Yeah, from the plunge and the plunge
to the pritch and the patch and the
munch. Can you imagine playing Petra and losing your lyrics and going from the blung and the flunk? It's like a June is busting all over moment.
Absolutely positive.
That would
happened.
Be me.
Please,
oh, yeah.
Please add us any Petras who have gone up during
it's
the Miller
It's a very
sun.
Far long from the fling and the flunk.
One of my favorites is not Sondheim related at all. I was at Disney and the singing Suitcase in a Dream. And the lyric is, so pack up your suitcase and start your dreaming. And I would make like a come on sort of motion. And for some reason, I said, so come on your suitcase and start your dreaming.
Pack up your suitcase, come on your suitcase. Honestly, and that's Little Night Music.
And I made eye contact with the sound guy who was operating everything from the iPad. And his eyes just like grew three times. Like, what did you just say? I'm like, I'm so sorry.
Come on your suitcase, la, la, la. Again.
Come on your luggage, la, la,
oh, my God. That's too good, Jeffrey.
Anyway.
There's nothing better than that.
All right. Thank you. Wait.
We haven't really talked about the movie version of the musical, but I guess there's not much to say.
Oh, I mean, it's there. I've often thought that A Little Night Music would have been better with a different director, the film
He
version.
Was too close to it.
What if Mike Nichols had directed it?
Wow.
You know, like maybe
who do you think would
worked.
Be, well, if they did it again, who would you think would be?
For a film
for
version?
For a musical, yeah.
Film musical version? It's a difficult piece, and Sondheim talks about this, that when you have like a 4-minute scene, song scene, like You Must Meet My Wife, that in film you could...
You have to do a lot.
Yeah, you kind of have to do really tricky things with editing and the camera.
So not Tom Hooper.
because really all of the emotions could be said in that scene with two close-ups and great acting.
Yes.
So it's then how do you justify it to be...
You'd have to open it up. They'd have to like go for a walk or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So maybe you do it as like a crazy one-take type... In your retail.
Anne Hathaway,
you know, I don't know.
It's funny because the moments where the movie version are the most successful, in my opinion, is where he opened it up so that, like, Weekend in the Country, for example, where they're a restaurant, then they're outside, and
then those cool cars. And
yeah, and it's not a disaster.
No,
it's
not a disaster.
And Liz Taylor, bless her heart.
She's actually my least favorite thing in the movie.
Yeah, she's very bad in it.
But, like, you can see Diana Rigg.
Oh, she's great.
Play Charlotte. She's
great.
Fantastic.
And Len Cariou was good.
Len Cariou?
Yeah.
I mean, let's go through our Tony Awards here.
Okay.
This is 1973.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, Pippin was the other big show besides Little Night Music. Also up for Best Musical that year were Sugar, which was the film version of Some Like It Hot. Or sorry, the stage version. The stage musical version of Some Like It Hot. And Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope.
Which
is one of those 70s musicals you were talking about earlier.
Yes, exactly one of those. That's the 70s would have been awash in those if we didn't have Sondheim.
Right. A Little Night Music wins over Pippin.
Yeah.
However, Bob Fosse wins for director and for choreographer.
Uh-huh.
Glynis Johns wins for best actress.
Good.
Len Cariou, who was the original Frederick, was up for actor. He loses, of course, to Ben Vereen.
Yes.
Because that's an iconic
that's
performance.
Fine. Yep.
In featured actress, our bald lady, Hermione Gingold, is nominated for Madame Armfelt, but she loses to Patricia Elliott, who played Charlotte.
Really? I didn't realize she won.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence, Guittard.
Yeah. Well, I don't actually know.
Yeah, but he's nominated for Carl Magnus. That voice. That's an incredible voice, right?
There's the note he hits at the woman's moan, and he holds it for a million years. Ugh, that's a man.
But that tone.
Yeah,
and gorgeous. I mean, his character drives me crazy, but I would listen to him sing anything.
But it's also, by the way, it's a great comedic character.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
He's not just toxic. He's also comically toxic.
It's making fun of masculine toxicity.
Exactly. It also wins for costume design. Mm-hmm. Florence Klotz. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then Sondheim wins for score, and Hugh Wheeler wins for book. So it has a really successful year at the Tony Awards, which makes the early 70s really belong to Sondheim.
And it ran for a long time and was financially successful.
Company to Follies. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
So good for them.
It's a wonderful piece.
And that's what Petra said to Fried.
That's what Petra said. Can we make that thing?
That's what Petra said. We're starting that. I like it. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for being here, Tom.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to Sondheim and all of the wonderful people who made this really elegant and horny piece of theater for us to enjoy. Please follow us on Instagram and Twitter at A Musical Podcast. And if you have any ideas or requests for shows that we cover here on the show, you can email us at amusicalpodcast@gmail.com. Yeah, I think that's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And I don't know, what should be the tagline for this
one? And as always, it's a very short road from the plump to the schmump, to the flump, to the schmump, to the clamshun. That's it. I don't know how it could get better than that.
Cue music.
Goodbye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.